If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Aber was ich noch erzählen wollte, meine Nichte kämpft sich ja ganz schön das Studium. Semesterbeitrag, Laptop, Bücher, Software, Handy, Internet. Ey, so ein Master ist echt teuer.
Ach, sag ihr, sie kann sich das zurückholen.
Ja, du meinst von der Steuer absetzen, ne? Aber sie verdient ja nicht.
Egal, Zauberwort Verlustvortrag. Macht sie ganz einfach mit Wieso Steuer. Und wenn sie dann arbeitet, heißt es Katsching.
Das geht?
Safe, Wieso Steuer.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück.
Jetzt kostenlos ausprobieren.
10.
Abbruch, Abbruch! Was ist los?
Hab Nutella vergessen!
Nicht so ernst.
Schmeckte schon himmlisch, bevor wir auf dem Mond waren. Nur Nutella ist Nutella.
Welcome back to Empire with me, Anita Anand.
And me, William Dalrymple.
To say it has not gone unnoticed how well you do that now.
I sit here with my family practicing it morning after morning.
Yeah, no, I'm proud of you. I am very proud of you. We're back on the path of gore, aren't we, again this week? This is another special week of Kohinoor where we throw two episodes dripping in blood.
And this episode, episode 3, contains your favourite bit, Anita, the roulette wheel of death, as you used to call it on our lecture tour.
I tell you what, there is an awful lot of killing, shooting and a stabbing and a poisoning that goes on in this particular bit.
Bludgeoning?
There's also a share of bludgeoning. I mean, basically, you name it. If Angela Lansbury were here, murder she wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, because there's a lot, is what I'd say.
So just for those of you who weren't up to speed, this is the third episode of our four-part series on the Kohinoor Diamond. In the first two episodes of this series, we took you through the history of this diamond, which in many ways is a symbol of the complexity of empire and empires. Many different peoples, many different kingdoms regard this diamond as their own. Many have fought for it and many still want it back, particularly, most obviously, India and Pakistan, but also Iran, Afghanistan and Bangladesh. Even the Taliban have put in a claim for this diamond.
I think it's safe to say they're the least likely to get it back, I think.
Any of it's going to happen very soon. But I think it's a very good place to start a podcast on empire, because it's not only a diamond which overlaps with so many different empires, but it's also one which symbolizes, in a sense, the heart of the imperial debate today, which is what is the consequence of centuries of colonialism, particularly European colonialism, and should we be looking at some sort of reparations in Britain? Should we be educating ourselves more about the consequences of centuries of loot and asset stripping from other parts of the world? How does one deal with the legacy of empire? All this is bound up in one tiny little stone.
Yeah. And although, you know, both William and I, in many respects, our artifacts of empire. I mean, artifacts or rubble.
No one's put us on a nice purple cushion.
No, not yet. But we're talking about more than just the British Empire and the British relationship with India. So we will, throughout this podcast series, be looking at empires from across the globe. But as William said, you know, just think of the Kohinoor in this respect as the most dripping with gore baton in a relay race.
It's a very nice image, Anita. It's a very gorgeous thing for our listeners to wake up and think about.
But it gives us an excuse to do a romp through centuries. So where did we leave off in the last episode?
We left off with the death of Ranjit Singh. Now, Ranjit Singh had taken the diamond from the Afghans, from Shah Shuja-ul-Mulk, when he was in his captivity. According to Shah Shuja, he tortured his son in front of him. But this is by no means the end of the relay race of gore, as my co-presenter so elegantly puts it. In fact, it's the beginning of what is probably the fastest moment of terrible events in the whole history of the diamond, which is the bit that you are, I think, going to open with, Anita.
I am. I mean, really fasten your seatbelts and have a sick bag. So Ranjit Singh closes his eyes.
Apologies for me if you're watching this at breakfast or listening to this at breakfast.
So Ranjit Singh has just closed his eyes. He is the one man who's managed to be a custodian of this diamond without meeting some tragic, horrific and deforming death. But when he closes his eyes, everybody knows that there's going to be a scramble for power. But nobody knows where the Kohinoor diamond has gone. And because this is a gem of state, that is of great interest to a great many people. The mystery can be solved through one actually quite minor court official in the court of Lahore. And it is that man, Belly Ram. If you were listening to the last podcast, you'll know this was the man who was the head and looked after the Toshakhana, the treasure house of Ranjit Singh. It was his responsibility whenever Ranjit Singh went riding around his empire on his elephant to make sure that nobody nicked the Kohinoor diamond. He slept with it. He would have slit the throat of anyone who came near it. But Belly Ram is the man who, as soon as Ranjit Singh breathes his last, takes the diamond and hides it. And he hides it for a very good reason, doesn't he? Because there is a very controversial episode, William, on his deathbed, on Ranjit Singh's deathbed, which until today is contested.
It's an interesting episode because what Ranjit Singh wants to do is to leave the diamond to a famous temple in Orissa, the Jagannath temple.
So the priests say. I mean, you ought to add, because this is something that others say, he couldn't even talk. He'd had a catastrophic stroke, so how did he do it?
I have half a memory reading the court. We wrote this book a few years ago, but I remember reading the court diary, and I think it's in there, for better or worse. And he says, I'm going to give it to Lord Jagannath. He doesn't name the temple itself, but what's interesting also is that theologically this is quite complicated for Sikhs because modern Sikhism abjures all idolatry.
Any idolatry, and
Hindu gods.
Yeah.
But if you go to 18th and 19th century Sikh Gurdwaras, there's plenty of images of Hindu gods. And we know for a fact that Ranjit Singh, when he died looking at an image, I think, of Ram and Sita.
Yeah. So, but this is something that's contested by the Sikhs, who say, actually, yeah, it's impossible, even if it's inserted into the court records, it's been inserted in nefarious ways, because number one, he was a Sikh. Why would he be giving the most precious diamond of the kingdom to a Hindu temple? And number two, he couldn't talk. He couldn't speak on his deathbed. So anyway, even on his deathbed, there is a controversy about
this. Put the case for it being true for one second, because it's controversial and very interesting matter, this. And I think the first people who actually put in the claim in 1947 for the return of the diamond from Britain was not the Indian government, but the Jagannath temple.
Jagannath in Orissa.
Correct.
That's right.
And when I gave this talk once in Orissa, all the Orissans were very clear that it was their specific diamond, that it wasn't belonging to India, it was belonging to Orissa and this temple. It is interesting because I remember you saying earlier that Sikhism is almost like a form of Protestantism. That's certainly the modern understanding of Sikhs, and Gurdwaras are very bare and there are no images, particularly in diaspora Gurdwaras in this country, in Britain. But what is interesting is that in the 18th and 19th century, if you go around a lot of old Sikh Gurdwaras, there are images of Hindu gods, not necessarily in the main prayer hall, but in the buildings around by and in the gatehouses, in the residential quarters and so on. And what has happened in the 20th century is that reforming Sikhs have often whitewashed these. Mm-hmm. And this happened at the Golden Temple. And there are images, for example, of the gateway into the Golden Temple, which have many of these images in the early 20th century, now completely bare. Mm. And there's been a very important destruction of Sikh art across Pakistan lately by diaspora Sikhs wanting to do the best thing and raising money to renovate old Gurdwaras that had not been touched since partition. Mm. And they've whitewashed many of the frescoes there in the last 2-3 years. And so the fact that he gave it to the Jagannath Temple is a doubly complicated
and,
thing.
And I'm going to argue against, you know, the position that is argued by the Sikhs, certainly, who say with as much gusto as those in Orissa, it's our stone, give it back to us. Don't give it back to India, give it back to the Sikhs. Is that actually Ranjit Singh was a very unusual Sikh leader because he married wives from different religions. So he had Hindu wives, he had Muslim wives, and he was the first person who ruled that part of the kingdom, the north of India. But the thing is that he is a man who is a polymath. he's also accepting of different religions and different faiths in a way that none of his predecessors for hundreds of years have been. So you, William talked about the jizya tax, which had been imposed by the Mughals, which was if you were not a Muslim and you wanted to practice your own, by some of the Mughals, you wanted to practice your own religion, you would have to pay a tax. Whereas when Ranjit Singh comes to the throne, he says no jizya. That's it. You worship the way you want. You do what you like. So it's possible that he wanted to give it to Jagannath. Anyway, the point is, who cares? Because where's the diamond? It's not here. So let's get back to Beliram. Then Beliram, despite the potential dying wishes of his master, for whom he would have spilt blood and died, has decided no. Even if Ranjit Singh has given this stone over, it wasn't his to give. So this minor, imagine the guts on this man. This minor court official has taken his duty of state so seriously. He is the son of the man who looked after the Toshakhana. His children are working in the Toshakhana. This is the family business. But he says no. And he doesn't take it for himself. He hides it away because he says the man who takes over as the Maharaja, this is his gem and I will hide it until then. You know, this is extraordinary. The next man, by the way, who is entitled
just
to wear
before
it,
we finish, Beliram, rather bizarrely, I was giving a lecture on this one afternoon when his entire family turned up at the reading.
You never told me.
I'm very proud of it, and they've got documents and all sorts of stuff. If we want to do any more,
come, you're just telling me this now.
Just suddenly remember.
Anything else you want to mention? Good God. So what did they? I mean, did they know how
they
brave?
Knew the story,
and they were very proud of his bravery.
And because I'd mentioned him in the talk, they came up afterwards and said, actually, and they were refugees from partition. They'd come over the border in 1947 and now living in Gurgaon.
So they'd been living in Lahore all that time.
Living in Lahore right up until
1947. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So it's hidden. No diamond, no king, no diamond, no diamond, no king. That's what Beliram has decided. But the next man who is entitled to wear that diamond, in the view of most of the people in the court of Lahore, is not fit to wear it. His name is Kurik Singh, who's the oldest son from the first wife of Maharaja Ranjit Singh. And this man is, well, you know how we've sort of described Rangila, who I liked, is the party central. He's a little bit like that, and the Sikhs really don't like it. Emily Eden, who's a great adventuress and a historian and a travel writer at the time, she's quite magnificent. She does sketches around India and writes about it, describes him.
A very piquant travel writer, and skewers everybody with her
quite
tight little sentences.
Very waspish. Yeah. She describes Kurik Singh as an opium-eating blockhead.
That's quite charitable in her lexicon.
She must have liked him. But you know, not wrong, because this was a man who preferred his own pleasure to matters of state. As soon as he becomes Maharaja, woohoo! weeks of
not over
feasting.
Endowed with intellect either, it should be said.
No. Yeah. Hence blockhead. I think.
Covers that. Yeah.
Covers that base. So he is barely on the golden gaddi, because he decides he will sit on the throne that his father doesn't sit on. His father, if you remember, Ranjit Singh leaves it empty for Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh faith. But Kurik Singh parks his fairly wide bottom on it and is comfortable. But almost immediately, his nobles decide he's got to go. And they start to poison him gradually, slowly, over months, by a mixture of white lead and camphor, rus camphor.
Which isn't a very nice way to go.
No, just, I mean, you know what it does to a human body. Not that you've poisoned anyone.
I know.
Not that you've done it. But it's slowly a neurotoxin. So it slowly robs a person of their faculties. Now, Kurik Singh doesn't help his own situation because he drinks a lot. He's sort of, you know, decried as a notorious drunk. So, you know, when he starts to wobble a bit on his feet, nobody really notices or cares because he's been wobbling for months. He starts to slur. Nobody really is that bothered because it's not unknown for him to be a bit slurry. But it's when he starts having terrible shooting pains in his fingers and his toes, which then spreads through his body. Then he loses the ability to walk. Then he cannot, and he's in screaming pain, like 1,000 needles are pricking his skin all the time. And he's just taken off and put to bed. He's still the king until he dies, but he's out of the way. And the nobles are basically the ones who are responsible for this poison plot. are waiting for his son, who is a much more...
And is Carrick Sean wearing the Kohinoor as he's having...
He wears it when there are state occasions, so when he is in front of the Lahore Darbar, but when he's sick. I mean, it would have been... It would have been taken away again. Belly Ram probably, you know, again, looking after it because, you know, one supposes they don't sleep with it on. it's uncomfortable. So, you know, so it's safely away from him, but it's waiting for a better recipient. And the better recipient is a 19-year-old boy called Nonihal Singh, who is Karak Singh's eldest son, who, unlike Karak Singh, is very responsible.
Also rather beautiful in the miniatures.
He's very beautiful.
Very good-looking boy.
He's got this sort of, you know, the very traditional North Indian features, sort of very aquiline nose, fair skin, angular, lean and fit. Whereas Karak Singh is this gnarly, bearded, wide load.
Old uncle.
Yes, exactly. So Karak Singh finally does die. And Nonihal is about to be, we don't crown them as king, but anointed as the new Maharaja. He doesn't make it past his father's funeral, William. Not even past his father's funeral.
The curse of the Kohinoor strikes again.
Well, this is why this starts gaining this particular momentum, really starts to stick that reputation. So Nonihal has just cremated his father. So he's covered in the ash and dust of the cremation. He goes to wash his hands in the river, and he comes back to the palace. Now, he's going to walk through the palace, in through the royal gardens, through a major gateway called the Hazuri Bagh Gate.
Which was built, I think, by Ranjit Singh to celebrate his capture of the Kohinoor from Shah Shuja.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, everything comes back to the Kohinoor. So, Nonihal, with two of his retainers, is walking through the Hazuri Bagh Gate, making his way to the palace. And suddenly, and completely inexplicably, a large block from the Hazuri Gate falls and it hits him and his companion, kills his companion outright, who's also a blood relative, a cousin of his. But according to the court records at the time, and an eyewitness, do you remember we talked about Alexander Gardner?
The tartan turbaned,
well, mercenary who was working for Ranjit Singh. He is an eyewitness to this. He's walking just a few paces behind Nonihal Singh, the crown prince, the Maharaja-to-be. And he says, you know, actually, Nonihal gets up and he's really grumpy because it's, you know, probably not lovely to watch your cousin bludgeoned to death by this great block. But he's okay. And he's offered a palanquin to take him away. And he says, no, I'm walking. And he walks back, which makes what happens next
all the more suspicious.
Suspicious. Very suspect. Because later that night, a physician called another Western physician, who's actually a homeopath called Honigberger, goes to see
him. We should say that the Sikh court is full of these sort of strange Europeans who've turned up, crossed through Europe and across
adventurers,
Asia.
Adventurers, actually, yeah.
And there's these strange ex-Napoleonic generals who've married Sikh women, have got huge families living in old Mughal tombs with long beards. Mm. Some of them return eventually and spend their days eccentrically in Saint-Tropez with these huge Sikh families. And one of them is Honigberger. And Honigberger spent a lot of time in the Northwest frontier digging early Buddhist remains. And he's a very important archaeologist. In fact, when you go to the Ashmolean and to the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, you see a lot of Honigberger's early, I mean, he's been looting and digging very unscientifically through these beautiful Hellenistic stupas, these very earliest Buddhist remains. But in this part of the story, he's doing his job, which
yes,
is
yes, he's
the,
going to go and visit Nonihal to see if he's all right.
Exactly.
When he goes, he's not all right.
He's
far from all right, because he's lying dead in his bedchamber and his head has been caved in. And there's grey matter, he describes grey matter being spilt on the pillow. Now, how is that possible that a man who walked away from a glancing blow, from a falling, mysteriously falling piece of masonry, has his brain splattered all over the bed? So this has clearly been yet another murder. Two kings in one fell swoop have gone. So this idea of the Kohinoor wreaking havoc already, you know, that Ranjit Singh was strong enough, the lion of Punjab was strong enough to wear it But let's see about his cubs.
This is also the period that you begin to get some Hindu writers suggesting that because of this history of bloodshed, that this is the Symantika gem we talked of in the first episode, that clearly the Kohinoor's old name was the Symantika gem, because like the Symantika gem, it leaves this trail of bloodshed wherever it goes, whatever the empire, whatever the period of history. It's done this extraordinary work of dividing people and creating conflict.
Yeah, and let's not forget, a lion ate it and then a bear ate the lion. It's a diamond that's got
This is the bug.
Four.
I need to say the Bhagavad Puran, which is from about the 10th century AD. We have the story about the Symantika gem.
Back to episode one if you want to hear that. It's a fun story. So look, this is now a Lahore in absolute crisis, because what are they going to do? Who is going to lead now? There are many queens of Ranjit Singh with many heirs, and if they decide that they're all going to fight for this, there's going to be a bloodbath. So Kurik Singh, the dead Maharaja, the one who is poisoned with the white lead and rust camphor, his wife is a woman called Chand Kaur. Her son has just died. Nonihal Singh has just died. But she decides, we have to keep this in the family. My God, we've got to keep this in the family, because there are other sons who are going to converge on the capital.
Circling the fort, like
sharks. Yeah. So she orders the gates of the Lahore fort to be closed, because she has Nornahal's wife, this young woman, and she's pregnant. And Chand Kaur is gambling everything that the child growing in her daughter-in-law's belly will be a boy. Please let it be a boy. Let it be a boy. Let it be. And, Lahore's just simmering with tension, but they're waiting. Because if it's a boy, there is a clear line of succession here.
And if there's nothing, then anarchy could break out.
Absolutely.
And the British are waiting just over the Sutlej.
Well, you're right, because the British, and just remind people, while Ranjit Singh's been on the throne, they haven't been able to get a sniff of the north, have they?
So Ranjit Singh controls what is arguably the richest agricultural land in the whole of India, the Punjab. And while he has been consolidating this empire with quite clear boundaries, the ocean to the south, the Himalayas and Afghanistan to the north, the Khyber Pass is his northern boundary, and with the Sutlej River marking him off from the rest of India. While this has been going on, a commercial company, the East India Company, has been using Indian mercenaries and borrowing money from Indian bankers to conquer the rest of India. And they've hoovered up an incredible amount of territory. One man, forgotten now, never appears in any European or English textbooks, but Lord Wellesley, who's the elder brother of the Duke of Wellington, conquers more of India than Napoleon conquers of Europe.
That's a great fact.
And he, in the series of wars from 1798 to 1805, Wellesley destroys the Maratha Confederacy, destroys Tipu Sultan. All this is done with incredible speed, so that by the time that Ranjit Singh is dead, the whole of the rest of India is either controlled by the East India Company directly through direct rule, or through a network of alliances with Indian princes who have all assigned acts of submission.
But this holdout citadel in the north, it just won't budge, and they won't go near it.
And under
because
Ranjit
they know.
Singh, it was fine, it was safe, and it had these Napoleonic generals, it had this incredible army.
It had
now,
guns, it had technology, it had tech, it had fighters, but now there's
like
chaos.
It's like the Tory party. It's this
keep bringing this analogy.
It's like a bag of ferrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is Chand Kaur looking at her daughter-in-law's swollen belly going, please let it be a boy, let it be a boy. Is it going to be a boy? Join us after the break to find out. Welcome back to Empire, the podcast about empires rising, falling, with me, Anita Anand.
And me, William Dalrymple.
So we left you just before the break with the most pressured mother-to-be, who is sitting there cradling a swollen belly with her mother-in-law going, better be a boy, otherwise we're done for.
That happens anyway in most situations.
True. But the whole of Lahore as well, simmering, praying, and whatever temples or mosques they go to, or gurdwaras they go to, so let it be a boy. And it's a boy.
But
it is a stillborn boy. Chand Kaur knows that's it. The jig is up. It will be a matter of hours before Sher Singh, who is the next legitimate claimant to the throne, is going to be on the march from his ancestral homeland in Batala, which is a
Sher Singh, we should say,
is
the kind of ultimate, the picture of him, the ultimate sort of man you don't want to sit next to in the tube.
No, he spreads somewhat, doesn't he? A little bit. I mean, imagine Brian Blessed with a bigger, bushier blacker beard. I mean, that's
taking up two seats.
For the Western audiences, you know what we're saying. So she knows he's going to, Sher Singh is on the way. And she orders the gates of Lahore Fort to be closed. People come terrified into the fort. Save us, those who are left outside, like, oh dear, what's going to happen here? And sure enough, Sher Singh lays siege to Lahore. Now, it's not a long siege, but it's a brutal siege. And there are people, that, you know, the people of Lahore are hammering on the gates, saying, please open the gates, let him in, we can't tolerate this. And with great reluctance, Chand Kaur, the Queen Mother, who has now lost in short order, let's remind ourselves, a husband, a son, and a grandson, is ripped with grief, frightened for her life and her daughter-in-law's life, and says, I will open the gates if we make a deal. You have to let us out, Sher Singh, and we will never trouble you again, but you are not to bother us again. And he says, fine, that sounds fair to me. Let me in. And she opens the gates. She's allowed to leave with her retinue, her daughter-in-law with her. And it seems like everything is settled. You know, Lahore has stability. It's not a year goes by when Chand Kaur is sitting in her own palace. She's supposedly in retirement. And her maids are brushing out her hair. You know, they're putting oil in her hair. They're brushing it out.
And this isn't going to end happily, I can tell.
Well, you're not wrong. Because suddenly and without warning, these handmaids pull out from behind their backs bricks and they bludgeon the Queen Mother to death. Now, could this be a mystery? It could have been. However, these women are dragged off by the vizier because actually conveniently Sher Singh is not in Lahore at the time this happens. He conveniently is not there. He's on a hunting expedition. So he can turn around and say, not me, Gov. It's nothing to do with me. However, what they do to these poor women is they chop off their hands and they throw them outside the city gates. Honigberger, the physician that we're talking about, who keeps a great contemporaneous record of what's going on at this time, says, actually, you know, they chopped off their hands, but they would have been better off ripping out their tongues because the whole time they were screaming, Sher Singh made us do it. Sher Singh paid us to do this. So there we are. The Queen Mother has gone. Does Sher Singh have a long and happy life with Kohinoor?
Well, it's funny you should say that.
Does he?
Of course, weirdly enough, Sher Singh doesn't. Hmm. Despite being this sort of mountain of Sikh manhood and spreading his legs and wearing the Kohinoor on his arm in his portrait.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, another man, the virility of the Kohinoor, the muscularity of the Kohinoor, you see it in court paintings.
At this period,
the time.
A wonderful portrait painter turns up, I think from Austria, called August Schrift.
Yeah.
And paints the whole Durbar. So amid all this swirl of bloodshed, not only do we have these fantastic records from Honigberger, we also have this astonishing series of portraits by Schrift. And he's the guy that paints this sort of fantastically sort of male picture of Sher Singh.
Yeah.
But he does it just at the right moment because Sher Singh is not around for long.
No, it's good he didn't hang about, frankly. Because on the 15th of September, 1843, I should do a little date marker here. This is where we are. Sher Singh is in his summer palace and he's invited his cousins round. And his cousins are saying, look, you've got to invite us round because we've got these new fowling pistols. We want to show you these fowling pistols. He's a very keen hunter, is Sher Singh, as you'd expect with a man who takes up two seats on the tube. And he likes hunting and a fishing, mostly hunting. And so they want to show him these guns. And all of a sudden, they bang.
Surprise, surprise, it goes off.
One goes off in his chest. And the cousins turn around and say, oopsie.
It was an accident.
But they really can't explain how, bang, it goes off for a second time in his face. And the Crown Prince Sher Singh's own son is found dead elsewhere in the palace and he's been hacked to pieces.
So who, on the basis of Cheshire FM, who gains from this murder?
Well, there is a period of bloodletting in the Lahore Durbar.
Surprise, surprise.
Where people who are vying for this diamond or for primacy in Lahore are just happily shooting, poisoning and chopping each other up. And the last man standing in 1843 is not a man at all. He's a little boy.
Chubby-cheeked.
Chubby-cheeked, doe-eyed little boy of 5 years old, long eyelashes, beautiful. This child is a beautiful, beautiful child. And his name is Dilip Singh. He's the youngest son of Maharaja Ranjit Singh from his youngest wife. This was not a kid who was ever meant to be king.
And the mother is an extraordinary figure. She's a great beauty for a start, but she's not from the courtly class. Her dad was, I think, kept the hounds of the kennels.
He is the kennel keeper. She's the kennel keeper's daughter. So her father was actually, I think, just quite a dreadful man called Olark Singh, who looked after the hunting hounds for Ranjit Singh. And from the time she's a child, basically this beautiful, celebrated beauty, just prepubescent and lovely, runs beside his master's horse saying, Do you want to feel more virile and young? In that case, why don't you marry my young daughter? She'll put fire back into your loins.
And even Ranjit Singh says no, age 10.
Yeah, no, absolutely no. And so Olark Singh asks, again and again and again. And only when she's 16 years old does Maharaja Ranjit Singh say, yes, I will marry her. And he marries this woman, Jindan, Rani Jindan is her name. And Rani Jindan becomes the mockery of the court because she's just the kennel keeper's girl. So, she's kind of snubbed and shunned and not taken seriously at all.
But she turns into one of the most remarkable women in the whole story. She is not a woman who is easily pushed aside.
She's amazing. She's one of my favorite characters in history. But her little son is also mocked and teased because for a while people say, how could the gnarled old Ranjit Singh, first of all, have produced an heir at all because he's so old? Second of all, a child of such beauty. And they start rumours and gossip.
And we should say, this is a face that many people will actually know, many listeners will know, because of the famous portrait of him done later in life by Winterhalter,
in Osborne House.
For example, on the front of the great Raj exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery, it's sometimes regarded as the greatest portrait to come out of the entire period of British
and
India.
Stunning. Yeah. It is stunning. And more on that a bit later. But if you have ever gone to Osborne House, it still hangs in a place of great prestige there, this beautiful young boy. Maharaja Dilip Singh.
Osborne in the Isle of Wight.
Isle of Wight. So, this tiny little boy is now the only one who can be the Maharaja because everybody else has done everybody else in. And the court of Lahore is delighted, because look, they've got a little boy, they've got a puppet. They can do whatever they want. They are de facto rulers, except one woman gets in their way, his mother, the kennel keeper's daughter, who is never meant to amount to anything, who everybody teased, says no. I will come out of the zenana, the women's quarters. I will sit with my son in my lap and I will rule for his interest. She has a brother who's going to help her out in this. Unfortunately, her brother is a bit of a louse. He is a wheeler-dealer, Del-boy type character who is deeply unpopular. They're both, these terrible, terrible siblings in the view of the very noble-blooded Lahore Darbar. Who on earth do they think they are that they're going to take control and they're going to tell us what to do? So right from the get-go, right from the moment Dilip Singh assumes power in Lahore, there is frothing and discontent. And who likes a froth better than the British?
No one more than the British.
So what is the thinking? What's the calculation, the calculus going on among the British at
this
time? So
the British have been preparing for this. And again, we should be careful to say this is not the British government. This is still the East India Company, which is, like Google or Facebook or ExxonMobil, is a corporation that's run by its shareholders. Increasingly now, the British government has turned it into something like a public-private partnership, but nonetheless, it's self-governing. And waiting in the wings, the company has put 3/4 of its Bengal army directly on the Satluj, and there's this huge cantonment, and there's a whole spying machine also, rather like Berlin in the 1930s or 1960s, with this whole spy network because everybody spying on everyone else. Ludhiana is the British centre of espionage, and they're sending out Indians dressed as pilgrims to measure the Himalayas. They're worried about the Russians just over the Afghan border. And it's a huge centre of intrigue. So this is the very much the era of the beginning of the great game. Mm. And there are two things that the British are spying on out of Ludhiana. One is the Russians, who are heading at a rate of about 100 miles every decade southwards to walk through what is now Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and so on towards the Afghan border, towards the Oxus. And they're also spying on the Lahore court. And they've been waiting for this. They know that while Ranjit Singh is alive, there's no way that with his Napoleonic generals, it's just not going to be worth invading. But as soon as they can create dissension and factions, they can take advantage. And this is what they've been doing throughout India. At this stage, funny enough, the British do not use the phrase divide and rule. It's such a thing. I've always been looking out for it in all my historical research in the primary sources, because it's such a thing in the secondary sources. People always say the British divide and rule. They didn't use that phrase at this period, but they certainly did it.
Yeah,
and they knew how to take advantage of divisions. They'd done this in Hyderabad. They'd done this with the Marathas in particular. They'd taken all the different Maratha kingdoms and set them against each other. Particularly, Lord Wellesley had this brilliant strategy just a few years before this, when they were taking on the great Maratha army, which was, like the Sikhs, was run by European mercenaries, had fantastic cavalry, fantastic artillery. And what they managed to do was they managed to capture a letter from one Maratha leader slagging off the other, and then let it look as if it had fallen into his hands by mistake, so that Holkar and Scindia, who were the two leaders, ended up not joining forces, and the company could take them out one by one. Exactly the same now happens.
Well, that's what they're doing in the court of Lahore. So they know that people are really fed up with Jindan and her awful brother. So they start doing some deals. They say to her vizier, the person who should be advising her, and one of her generals, when the time comes, we will ask you to betray your king. And if you do betray your king, we will reward you. We will reward you with your own kingdoms. We will carve this place up and we'll make it worth your while. And that's exactly what happens.
So 1845, we know?
1845. So we're in 1845. Jawahar, the brother of Jindan, is, because emboldened by this idea that these two are not going to be here for long, you know, the British are making promises and it's such a restive kingdom. Little Dilip is on an elephant with his uncle, and the court comes around the elephant. The faithful, you know, the really faithful Sikhs come around and they surround the elephant. And they say, this man is a drunkard and he's dissolute and he's immoral. And he's also spilt royal blood. They say that he's intrigued his way and he's been part of this poisoning plot to get rid of rivals. They pull him off the elephant and they cut him to pieces, and the blood splatters little tiny infant Dilip. It's one of his earliest memories, is of being covered in his uncle's blood. Without him, now, this is a really exposed queen and a little boy with very little to protect them. And it is in that situation that the first Anglo-Sikh war takes place.
And it's one of the great, most hard-fought conflicts of the East India Company's military history, because they're not taking on old-fashioned Mughal armies who are using outdated cavalry techniques. The Sikhs can match them gun for gun, musket for musket. In fact, in many ways, the Sikh guns are rather better than the East India Company ones. They've got these extraordinary artillery makers in Lahore who've come from Europe. And the East India Company knows this and realizes the only possible hope is if they can create the division that they've just managed to do.
And they do. And, you know, the two men that they've paid off do betray their king at the right time.
And even when they defeat the Sikhs in battle, they realize that they can't just march in and conquer the country and move in the way they did, for example, in Tipu's kingdom in the south, because they realize that the Sikhs are united against them and that it'll be a disaster. So they create a very sort of clever technique
a diplomatic solution where they say, look, we come as friends and you're an unstable kingdom and we don't like this kind of instability and you mustn't like this kind of instability. Let us help you. So we will be friends. We will rule this place in your name. You can still be the Maharaja, little boy, and your mother, she must. But, you know, when it comes to your age of majority, we'll leave as friends. And that way we have a huge ally and we'll protect you. Now, you know, everybody, again, Lahore's been through a lot at the moment. So everybody starts breathing a sigh of relief. Generals stand down, armies are at rest, they go back to their fields. But one person is not quiet, and that's Rani Jindan, who is screaming at her courtiers, "What are you doing?" She shouts, you know, "What are you doing? Do not trust them. They are biding their time. They're going to take everything." And in the meantime, this sort of bemused little boy with, just imagine this tiny spindly little arm with this big diamond on it, which is completely outweighing his mass and also his ability, is there on show. Now, there's somebody, again, who's got a close eye on this diamond, because the British are there and, you know, they're quite happy for a while, you know, under Henry Harding. This is a good arrangement. He doesn't want to take Lahore. It's too hard to take Lahore.
But we've got a new man in who is Dalhousie.
Now tell us a little bit about James Andrew Brown Dalhousie.
So Dalhousie is the classic sort of ambitious old Etonian who is hoping to, when he retires from being viceroy, to become foreign secretary or even prime minister.
I can't imagine a modern trajectory like that.
And he's bright and ruthless, and he realizes that what he wants above all, although he's actually employed by the East India Company, is he wants to give the Koh-i-Noor to Queen Victoria, and that will keep, in a sense, his place at the in Downing Street warm for him, because with the Queen's influence, with her support, who knows what's possible. So he has this plan all lined up. But the first thing he needs to do is to get rid of Jindan.
He needs to get rid of Jindan, and that is what happens. So Jindan is removed. She's called, first of all, they start actually disparaging her and undermining her. So they start referring to her in British circles as the Messalina of Punjab, the whore of Punjab. They start to reseed the gossip of his childhood that this is not the legitimate child of Ranjit Singh. Ranjit Singh claims him as a legitimate heir, but no, they say no. He is the product of an affair between his whore mother and a water bearer, a Bishti, in the court. So he has not one drop of
this
noble
blood.
This
is the story they put out.
The propaganda that
almost
goes
certainly
out.
Not true. Yeah.
And then, well, I mean, who knows? Who knows? But they don't know. Who knows? You know. So they drag away his poor mother.
To actually a rather nice place, to Sheikhupura, where there is, I mean, if you're going to be locked up somewhere near Lahore, it's not a bad place to begin your exile. The palace where she was is still there, and it's got the original frescoes. It's one of the great sites. If ever you have the chance to visit Lahore, go out to Sheikhupura. And there's two lovely things. One is a gorgeous lake with a octagonal structure built by the Emperor Jahangir, the Mughal Emperor Jahangir, for his favourite deer. Oh. It's called the Hiran Minar. Mm. And then next to it is this extraordinary palace full of frescoes from this period. And anyone interested in art history of the Pahari Art School and Sikh art needs to make a beeline for this, because they're completely intact and completely perfect. So this is where Rani Jindan is sort of rattling around, unable to leave and under house arrest.
Although, I mean, I don't think any frescoes or any number of frescoes in the world will help her heart, because at the moment she is in absolute agony. And we know she's in agony. She's been separated from her only child, who is a very small boy. And she writes these absolutely pitiful letters to Henry Harding, the resident of Lahore, saying, just give me my son back. Please give me my son back. He's all on his own. He has nobody with him. I won't trouble you again. I won't ask for anything. I don't want anything. Just let us leave. Just give me my boy. Please just give me my boy. And Harding's actually moved by these letters. But Dalhousie, not one bit. And now the stage is set with the little boy king all on his own for the final act of the British takeover.
And it's provoked by the British moving yet more forces up to the Sutlej border. Already, I think 3/4 of the Bengal army is camped out on the border, ready to invade, rather like the Russian forces building up in the months before the invasion of Ukraine. And everyone, again, like the Russians, can see them massing there. So eventually a Sikh party cross the Sutlej into the British side to make a demonstration of resistance. And this is the trigger that allows the company to move in properly.
So, and the reason it's one of those controversial moments in history is that it's a raiding party. It's a raiding, but a small party on horse that crosses the river. And the British say it's an invasion. Yeah. They say it's the causa spele. It's the reason that they will go to war.
And in the swirl of rumours, there are some people suggesting that, in fact, this raiding party is even put up by
the British side to give them a reason.
And again, we have some extraordinary battles when...
Oh, Chilianwala is just so bloody. I mean, talk about Chilianwala. That's a
horrendous battle. One of the great conflicts of Indian history. Mm. And the two best armies of the time go at it. And in fact, the guns from... Chilianwala are now in London. If you go to Chelsea Hospital onto the front lawns, you can see them all lined up there. And next time you're at the Chelsea Flower Show, you can pop around and see them. A rather unlikely place. And because the British were so proud of this victory, because it was their most formidable enemy. Mm. But some of the generals are already in company pay. They've already been... The position, I think, of the of the artillery, for example, has been betrayed to the British in advance.
Mm.
And it ends in the Second Treaty of Law, which is 1849. And this is the one...
This is the one that settles the fate of the Koh-i-Noor and of Dilip Singh, because actually, you know, this is
also
very...
and this is important, but it also settles the fate of Lahore.
Yes.
And this is the treaty which gives Kashmir to the Dogras. And so the whole, I mean, a lot of modern Indo-Pak conflict is centered on this particular clause of the Second Treaty of Lahore. So a lot of, you know, in a sense, the what's often said to be the most sensitive nuclear trigger in the modern world, certainly up to Putin and Ukraine, is the Lahore.
Is armed and loaded by the Brits.
Is armed and loaded by the 1849 Treaty of Lahore when Kashmir is given to the Dogras.
So. Well, look, so now, 1849, you've got Dalhousie, Buhis, who's on the scene, who says, right, you know what, I want all of it. So this Maharaja's got to go. So he's got to get out of Lahore. There's actually a really very powerful etching of this, which is the little boy.
From the Illustrated London News.
Yeah, and he's standing surrounded by these epauletted soldiers, you know, speaking a language he doesn't understand, with nobody who really cares about him anywhere near him.
He's already, again, this now little, very elegant little seven-year-old, nine-year-old?
Nine-year-old. And he is forced to sign over everything. And the Koh-i-Noor is actually scheduled very high up in the number of things. So I think it's sort of, I think comes right after signing over all rights to Lahore.
But what, again, is crucial is that it isn't given to the East India Company.
No.
It's given to the Queen.
Which actually there was no mandate. The East India Company goes wild about this. They're like, who the hell do you think you are, Dalhousie?
Giving our diamond.
We've spent all the money on the armies. We're the ones who, you know, have lost all the blood and coin here. Who are you to give this? But he has a plan. You know, this is his fast track to power.
And
as
also,
well.
they can't publicly say this.
Because they can't have it to the Queen. They're like, oh yes, Your Majesty. Hope you like it.
Gift.
Hope you like it. So there's the diamond is now going to Queen Victoria. Dilip Singh is sent away from Lahore, and even now, you know, there are laments in Punjab. I can't stress this enough. This is such an open wound in the psyche of Sikhs. Punjabis in general, but Sikhs in particular, that their little boy king was so cheated and traduced and taken away. And, you know, there are reports at the time of, you know, Lahore being lined with weeping people as their boy king is taken away. And he's taken away and he's given to foster carers, a Scottish couple, actually a really delightful Scottish couple. I think they're nice people, but they're still not his parents. He is going to be sent away to Fatehgarh, which is now in present day UP. And the Logans, it's worth sort of mentioning the Logans. John Logan is a medic, and he is arguably the most honest man in Punjab. Apart from Belly Ram, he is a man who is entrusted with looking after all the gems and actually doing the inventory of the Toshakhana. And his writings are really fascinating. And he's the one who first lays eyes on the Koh-i-Noor and describes it and the wonder of it and the heft of it. But he also, every single gem and coin, he is the one who's accounting for it.
After the conquest, he is the one, I think, who gives the chit.
Yes,
to
the receipt.
Dalhousie.
Yeah, exactly.
And Dalhousie has to sign, I have received the Koh-i-Noor.
That's right. There is paperwork. Yeah. And the Brits are very good at paperwork. It's very good for a historian, actually, the paper trails that are left behind. But, you know, having given over the diamond, he gets the boy. He gets the king. And Dalhousie says, just take him away, far away, and just look after him. And he, with his wife, Lena Logan, become de facto parents for the little boy.
Where is Rani Jindal at this point?
She has been locked away, but she manages to get one loyal to her to come who delivers food with a basket of clothes, and she leaves dressed as a washerwoman. So she sneaks out into the night somehow, and goodness knows how, because she hasn't got means and she's, you know, worth a lot to the British. She makes it all the way to Nepal. And she throws herself on the tender mercies of the Bahadur of Nepal. Turns out, not very merciful, because he knows that she's worth a lot. So he gets in touch with the British and goes, you might be interested in who I've got here. Do you want her? And the British say, no, actually, just keep her. You just keep her, because when she's with you, she's out of trouble. And he keeps her, and she sort of lives in sort of house arrest in Nepal. She's in Nepal. She's living a comfortable life, but she's not free. It's sort of a glorified house arrest. Anyway, and Dilip Singh, in the meantime, is being brought up by a very sweet couple, traumatized, one must imagine. This boy's been splattered with blood not so long ago, has seen his kingdom fall, has seen his mother taken screaming away from him. And he tries almost immediately to be the best boy. Can I be the best boy, you know?
And he learns to do British
blind man's buff. He puts away his Persian poetry, picks up
Shakespeare.
He puts away all of the Sikhism of his past and he starts reading the Bible.
And this is the point when he kind of really breaks the heart of all the Sikhs.
Well, already a grieving Lahore who've lost their king. And it happens over a number of years. So he becomes more and more inquisitive about Christianity. He's absolutely obsessed with the Rani of the world, you know, Victoria, this mother figure who, you know, he's told is the mother of the empire.
Who he started writing to.
Yeah, and who is enchanted by him, who thinks he's utterly fascinated. She asks for reports, regular reports about Dilip. And, you know, he's beautiful. He is charming. He speaks very good English. This is a woman who's never going to see her Eastern Empire, but she has this totem of what it is to be Maharani of India. And so, you know, there's this sort of dual obsession which starts developing between this little boy and this queen in England. And we'll come to that in a minute. But in the meantime, the diamond. So the diamond is still in Lahore. Dilip is safely out of Lahore. And the diamond, now Dalhousie has to get it the hell out of Lahore because, you know, as long as it stays in the Punjab, there is a chance somebody else will steal it and then they will have the emblem of power and he can't have that.
So there's some wonderful stories at this point. We've had in previous
We thought this
moments,
was going to be a three-part. It's not, is it? We're going to four parts, aren't we? We're going for an epic. Uh-huh.
So there's some wonderful little moments in the history of the Kodor. There's that moment we've already had when it ends up as a paperweight on a mullah's desk. He doesn't realise what it is. Now, Dalhousie decides to become the kind of diamond runner himself, doesn't
he? It's so hilarious. So, you know, this is, first of all, the diamond, when it's signed over and he signs the chitty, is given to a group of three wise men who are in Lahore, including a man called John Lawrence, who's this swashbuckling character who's a great soldier.
John Lawrence, I should say, is rather a hero in that he's one of the few Brits from this period who stands scrutiny from our point of view today.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
In years to come, when the great uprising, the 1857 mutiny breaks out, which we're going to talk about in a later podcast, it's John Lawrence who stops the massacres and then actually saves quite a lot of Mughal Delhi from destruction. There'd been a plan to destroy the great Jama Masjid, arguably the greatest Mughal mosque of all, and replace it with a Gothic cathedral. We haven't got that Gothic cathedral, thanks to John Lawrence.
Thanks to John Lawrence.
Anyway, at this point, though, he's not particularly interested in jewellery and bling.
No, so this is the problem. It's not one of his finest moments. So he's given the diamond to look after, because, you know, he's a very brave man, a very strong man, and he takes the diamond and he puts it in his waistcoat pocket and he says, I will look after it, Lord Dalhousie, until the moment you need it. You can rely on me. And he probably forgets where he puts it. So when Dalhousie,
the most valuable diamond in the world, goes missing.
Crackers. A year later, roughly, Dalhousie then says, right, you know what? I'm going to get it out of Lahore because it's just too, it's, this rock is too hot. We got to shift the hot rock. And he says, okay, John, where's the rock? And John goes, where's the rock? Oh, God, where's the rock?
It's one of those moments, you know, you've lost your phone, you've lost your charger, you can't find your credit card, but it's worse.
So he goes home, he turns everything upside down. This is according to him. And according to Boswell, the man who does his biography, says, you know, he looked everywhere, he couldn't find it. So he shouts at his valet, like, you know that waistcoat I was wearing that time? There was something in the pocket, where is it? And the guy goes, over that rock. Oh, I put it over here. I mean, thank God. Can you imagine?
So the manservant has put it in a little drawer.
He's just put it in a little drawer somewhere safe from harm. And so he has no idea again what it is. Gives it back to Lawrence, who says, Thank God. And then gives it to Dalhousie. And you're quite right. Dalhousie doesn't trust anybody with this diamond because it is now really such a hot rock. Its political significance, its value, everything makes it a target. So he has this very small circle of trust. The three wise men, including Lawrence, who were looking after it. He tells his wife, he tells his nephew, and he himself is going to be the diamond mule to get it out.
And Lady Dalhousie knits him a little muffler for it.
It's a little purse. She sews. I mean, honestly, this is a woman I guarantee has not sewed on a button for the last 30 years. And yet somehow, because she's trusted, she makes a little pouch, a kid's skin pouch with loops around it for a golden chain, which will fasten around our housie's neck and around his waist. So if someone tries to grab it and, you know, slits his throat, it's still attached to his body from the waist.
I didn't know that. It's around his neck too.
Around his neck and around his waist. So it is now doubly secured on Dalhousie, who is now going to hard gallop it with his nephew to Bombay to get it the hell out of India and over to Queen Victoria.
And then they find, rather like with sort of British Airways now, all the flights are cancelled, they find that all the ships have gone off to fight some other war and they haven't got any ships going to
London.
There's
nobody available. Yeah. And what they want is, they don't want a big ship and they don't want something that's attracting attention. They want something that is fast, that is small, that is completely unnoticeable. And they have to wait for about a year until the right ship, a year. So they finally find the ship and it's called the Medea. And it's a sloop. So it's, you know, it's fast.
A steam sloop.
So it's, you know, one a very
latest technology. Yeah.
Up to date, state of the art, and it'll get there quickly. The man who's in charge of this steam sloop is a man called Lockyer.
And Darcy sends his nephew with it?
He sends his nephew, and there is an official from the East India Company, because they're still a bit ticked off this whole... Wait, I mean, actually, they do get their revenge, because Dalhousie in his mind has this whole thing of, I give unto you, Queen Victoria, the Koh-i-Noor, and they say, no, it's not yours. We're going to give it to her. You can wind your neck in and stay at home. And he's furious about it. You know, he's really livid that these sort of apparatchiks are taking the glory from him, but that's the way it is. So it's loaded onto this steam sloop, the Medea. Captain Lockyer is only told at the very last minute what he's carrying. The crew are not told at all. They just know that there is a casket which is being loaded on. And inside that casket is another casket. Inside that casket is another casket. All of them have different keys. And each man is given a key. So not one person on the Medea can open all three unless they kill the other two. That's such as the security Brilliant. Of the diamond.
Brilliant. So something tells me that this is not going to be an easy voyage, but we're going to save the story of the Medea and its terrible journey to England for the next episode. Goodbye from me, William Dalrymple.
And me, Anita Arnon.